Call the Agriculture, Rural Development, and Housing Finance Committee to order. A quorum is present. Members, today we've got a presentation and an overview of an elevator situation in Ashby. Many of you have maybe heard about this, heard about other elevator situations that have went insolvent in the past, and this situation occurred in the past 6 months in my district, bordering Senator Ingebrigtsen's district up in the northeast corner of Grant County, just north of Elba Lake where I live, close to Fergus Falls and Alexandria, between those two towns on I-94, to give you a perspective of location. But members, we'll get into an overview from the Department of Ag, who's been on the ground with this situation, and just wanting to gather more facts, find out what happened in this situation and maybe prior situations that the Department of Agriculture will share with us and the stakeholder group that they've been meeting with for several months, talking about any changes that may need to be looked at, or what could have or wouldn't have prevented this situation, and ultimately protecting farmers from bringing grain into a storage facility and being assured that they'll get cash when they sell their grain or bring their grain into a situation. I've analogized it a lot to a bank that you or I may put our cash in a savings account. We expect that money to come back when we go to draw it out. For farmers, grain is their cash in most cases, and they need to be able to count on that in their elevators as well. And largely, we have a great group of co-ops and network of elevators, but this situation has certainly left a small town in a tough situation, as well as farmers and other patrons and small banks. And so we want to hear more about it and continue the dialogue and hear from the stakeholders as well. And so welcome to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture first, and then we've got a representative from the co-op in Ashby representing the bankrupt co-op at this time, as well as representative for some farmers that were involved in this matter, and then other ag interest groups that want to also talk to us about this, and we want to hear from them as well. So welcome, Department of Agriculture. If you can identify yourself for the record, and we'll try to limit it to within 30 minutes or less if we can. By the time we have questions, 15, 20 minutes of presentation, if you can keep it to that, and we'll keep this moving along. Thanks for being here. Introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us today. My name is Whitney Place, and I serve as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. As you mentioned, we have started a grain advisory committee at the department to kind of discuss our grain licensure programs and how we can improve protections for farmers. Today, I brought along some of my staff who work on our grain licensing programs, Nick Milanowski, who is our section manager who oversees our grain licensing, and Christine Mader, our program administrator for these licensure programs. They'll walk through kind of our programs, what happened in Ashby, and we're happy to answer any questions after.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nick Milanowski. I'm the section manager for the fruit, vegetable, and grain program within the Plant Protection Division of the Minnesota Department of Ag. I want to start here giving an overview of our grain licensing program, the intent of the program, what we do, and the amount of facilities that we license through the program. First and foremost, the program exists to protect producers in the event that they are failed to pay or fail to be paid for their grain once it's delivered to an elevator or a storage facility. We have 327 entities that are licensed through the program. That covers over 600 licensed locations. An entity can have multiple locations that are covered under our program. We have $54 million in bonds that are on file with the program that are there to protect the producers in the event of a failure to pay. And Through our last licensing cycle, we had over $12 billion of grain reported as being sold in Minnesota, sold and purchased in Minnesota. And our licensing program also covers over 337 million bushels of grain stored within the state. One important distinction here is that you can hold a storage license with the state of Minnesota, or you can also hold a storage license with the USDA. You do not need to hold both in the state of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Department of Ag recognizes that storage license from the USDA. When we are talking about licensed facilities and insolvencies, one of the most recent is the Porter Elevator. Porter Elevator, the insolvency occurred in 2015, and they held a USDA license to store and Minnesota Department of Agriculture license to purchase grain. So the most important definition that we have to lay out here is surety bond. Licensed entities are required as part of the license to hold a surety bond or a alternative that's defined in statute. And a bond is essentially money that is set aside for the producers to make a claim against. It's a amount of money defined in statute that is based off of the previous year's purchases or stored grain liabilities. Those are, again, defined by how much was stored in the previous license year. Right now, we are collecting that information for next year's licensing period. We have a bond range that covers small facilities that only are required to hold a $10,000 bond, all the way up to our max bond, which is $500,000. Some of our larger facilities that are purchasing billions of dollars in grain, they only have to hold a $500,000 bond. And I'll cover this multiple times throughout this presentation, but the total sum of the bond is available for producers to make a claim. So in the case of Porter Elevator, we had 11 valid claims, over $1 million. Their bond on file was $125,000. They were paid out pro rata for those claims to the tune of roughly 11% of what they had claimed in the Porter insolvency. And the bonds typically cost the elevators and the grain buyers between 1 and 3% of the total value of the bond. So annually they are required to pay for this bond level. If, let's say it's a $100,000 bond, they may have to pay between $1,000 or $3,000, depending on the financial stability and the assessment that the surety bonding companies make of those elevators. Another important clarification here is voluntary extension of credit contracts. These are more commonly known as deferred payments or delayed price. That's what most people will refer to them as. We call them VECC contracts, and it's an agreement between buyer and seller to delay payment beyond what's defined in statute as a cash sale. Statute defines a cash sale as grain being delivered and then payment being produced to the producer within 48 hours. If it extends beyond that, it's considered a voluntary extension of credit contract. It needs to be reduced to writing, recognized by both parties, buyer and seller, and there's some other rules in terms of the language that are included in each contract. And so we've seen an issue in the past where these contracts aren't reduced down to writing, and so they default to a cash sale. In the case of the Porter Elevator, we saw a lot of contracts that had not been reduced to writing, and the precedent that's been set in previous instances was that they default to cash sales. Ashby Elevator, I need to preface this with the investigation by the MDA is still ongoing. We are still receiving claims against the insolvency for the Ashby Elevator, and so some details we are not able to share today, but what we can share is that the elevator was closed on September 14th, 2018. We sent an inspector to the facility immediately. We collected the license from the the board of directors and the attorney for Ashby Elevator that was on hand that day. They hold a current bond of $125,000, so that is in place to protect the producers that are currently unpaid by Ashby Elevator. To date, we have received 34 claims, over $2.5 million in those claims, but they are still coming in. Our period for receiving claims is through the middle of March, and then we have roughly 40 days after that deadline to issue a payment through the bond process and determine the validity of all the claims. We're currently working with the Attorney General's office to get through those. They are helping us look at the documents that have been provided by the elevator and that have been provided by producers in these claims to dig down and understand what would be considered valid and what would be invalid through this process. Minnesota Department of Agriculture has had bond claims in the past. Fortunately, we haven't had any prior to Ashby Elevator since 2015. We had two in 2015. The most commonly known or most widely heard about was the Porter Elevator. Porter Elevator had roughly 11 claimants, over $1.1 million in valid claims. We had actually received over $2 million in claims, but a good portion of them were deemed invalid. We also had a North Country Seed in 2015, and this was a single claimant for close to $1.5 million against North Country Seed, and they received only 8.5% of their claimed value because the bond for North Country Seed was, again, $125,000. You can see here, these dates go back to 2011. Of course, we had claims prior to then. We do have some claimants that did receive 100% of their claimed value of their grain that they were not paid on. Those were typically single claimants, whereas some of these lower values, like North Country Seed, Porter Elevator, were multiple claimants, and so they were paid pro rata. Prior to the Ashby Elevator closure, we had started this grain advisory group. Many of the members are here today, prepared to speak about what we've discussed in this grain advisory group. This was something that came out of continued conversations from that Porter Elevator closure in 2015. There was legislation proposed in the 2016 session, 2017 session, and we continued to talk to industry about it and opted to bring in all the industry players to have a broader discussion on what ways we could better protect producers, whether it's through procedural changes through the MDA, through more robust financial reviews, or increased bonds, indemnity fund. This group has covered a wide variety of components to the grain statute and grain licensing. We've had three meetings to date, so we're just getting started. Some of the things that have come out of it are implementing standards for audits, financial audits of these facilities. Currently, facilities are not required to submit financial reviews, submit financial compositions or audits to our office. We can request them if they're available, that we were granted that that authority in Statute 223 and 232. But they're not required to submit them every year for our review. Another topic is increased inspections. Our grain buyer's license does not require an annual inspection. There's no requirement in statute for that. Our grain storage license does require two inspections, one by the MDA and one can be performed by the Minnesota Department of Ag or another party that is experienced in grain measurement and grain auditing. There are several third-party entities around the state that offer that service. And again, these are a lot of what we've discussed is changes to policy that can be implemented through statute changes that don't necessarily address the indemnity fund or changes to the bond scale. These are things that we think we can improve and make our inspections more robust to potentially catch some insolvency or failure ahead of time. But we also acknowledge that that may not be the case in the case of blatant fraud or misrepresentation of the facilities. With that, I have reached the end of my presentation. It's a very brief overview of our grain program, and open it up for any questions you may have.
Nick, does Christine want to offer any comments, or are you open for questions?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Dietzick has a question.
Thank you, Senator Sparks. So when you were discussing on the voluntary extension of credit contracts, you mentioned the contract was reduced to writing or wasn't reduced to writing. Can you help me and explain what you mean by that? So was it never put in writing?
Mr. Chair,
or
members,
an oral agreement?
Yeah.
Mr. Milanowski?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if contracts are not reduced to writing, if they don't have specific language on the contract and are both signed by the buyer and seller of the grain, they are recognized as cash sales and being covered by the bond. If the seller and the buyer both acknowledge the risk that comes with these voluntary extension of credit contracts, they are not covered by the bond protection. So, in the case of Porter Elevator, we did have several claimants that had contracts that were not properly signed by both parties and did not have the necessary language on them, and so they were covered by the bond. I hope that answers your question.
And to that, Mr. Milanowski, Ashby, what did you find in the Ashby situation with contracts? And then I've got a follow-up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I stated before, this is an active investigation. I can share that we are going through the documents. We've presented them to the Attorney General's office. Some of the documents aren't available, and so we are working to find everything that we have that would make sure that we have a clear representation of what was occurring at the elevator and can allow us to make the best judgment on the validity of all the claims. To date, we have not received any signed contracts.
Mr. Milanowski, you talked about the two different licenses. Can you explain them a little bit further about two inspections a year for grain buying license? Would that catch something like this? Or my understanding in Ashby, they only held one license. Or can you clear that up for us, and why wouldn't have the inspections caught this, or what could we change so they would have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, absolutely. The Ashby elevator held a grain buyer's license. A grain buyer's license does not require an inspection. If we had been to the facility, which we had, I should say we did visit that facility in 2018 prior to the failure, and we had seen all the records that they had and given a thorough review of grain on hand and the grain that they were claiming to own, we may have noticed some discrepancies in their reporting. The reason we were there in 2018 was because of a special request from the elevator to inspect only what they had at their grain elevator on their premises and not their reported grain that they held elsewhere. And so our inspection only covered a small portion of their operation. This was at the request of Ashby Elevator.
So, Mr. Milanowski, you made the comment, had you done a more thorough inspection, you may have seen some of the discrepancies. Can you expand on that a little bit more and why, help us understand why that more thorough inspection wasn't done in this situation?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, The what I was referring to as a more in-depth inspection would be similar to what we do for a grain storage exam. So we are measuring every bin that the elevator would have, every pile of grain that they would have on site. Grain buyers, again, are not required to have an exam. We had been asked to perform a special exam, what we refer to as a special exam for this elevator, and those are done at the request of the elevator and only entail what we are asked to inspect. They pay for that as a outside of their license. And so when we visited this elevator, we were examining a small portion of it. It wasn't the full breadth of what the elevator had on the records.
Follow up, Mr. Milanowski. So they did not have a grain buyer's license. They just had, or they had a grain buyer's license. They didn't have the warehousing or storage license, and that's what triggers the more thorough inspections?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Dreheim has a question.
Thank you, Chair. So there was 327 entities. Is that both USDA and Minnesota licensed?
Mr. Milanowski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, 327 entities. I should clarify, if they hold a USDA license in Minnesota to store grain, they are obligated to hold a... If they hold a USDA license in Minnesota to store grain, they're obligated to hold a Minnesota Department of Agriculture grain buyer's license. So those entities that are licensed by the USDA are also licensed by the MDA, just two separate license obligations, if that...
Follow-up, Chair.
Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. And is there anything different that the USDA does than that we do here in Minnesota for inspections and oversight?
Mr. Milanowski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. The USDA and the Minnesota Department of Ag both have very similar inspection protocols. We are members of a national organization that is looking, that works to unify our inspection protocols and measurement protocols. We use similar software to the USDA. There are some distinct differences. I'm sure my colleagues with Minnesota Grain and Feed can also answer this question. But the bonding for the USDA is different. Of course, there's different inspectors. But similar protocols in terms of measuring grain, looking at the financial records, the records that we have on hand, daily position reports, those sort of things.
Follow-up, Chair.
Senator Dreheim.
So they would have similar audits, and the time frame for inspections would be similar with USDA versus Minnesota.
Mr. Milanowski.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, absolutely. Yes, they have similar requirements and do require inspections on a regular basis.
Thank you.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In kind of along that same line, so can you just clarify, because I'm reading a letter, which I think somebody else will be testifying about later, is, and when they do either USDA or Department of Ag, when they do an inspection the same as an audit? And so when they do the inspections, how much financial stuff are they getting into? What specifically, is there a difference from like a layperson who isn't involved in the terminology you use every day, is there a difference between an inspection and an audit from when we hear of, you know, other nonprofits and organizations have to have a CPA audit, the cities have to have an audit, and so how is that similar or different from the inspections that you and USDA do?
Mr. Milanowski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a distinct difference between an audit and an inspection. An audit that entails a financial review is conducted by a CPA firm typically. Will take multiple days, if not weeks. They'll have many people involved in that audit. Oftentimes they're on site conducting that audit, and they have a financial background, looking for good financial practices that are in place and the systems in place to catch potential fraud or a failure to follow those practices. Our examinations through the grain program do not involve an audit in any way. We are inspecting documents. We're making sure that they have money on hand or money on their books to cover some of their obligations for these voluntary extension of credit contracts. They have enough grain on hand to meet their obligations for stored grain, and they have enough company-owned grain to meet any obligations they have that are outstanding for the people that are selling them grain. So very distinct and are not the same at all.
Senator DeTillo. So, Mr. Milanowski, to that question, is that you're covering the audits or the inspections when you verify those items, that there's enough grain on hand to cover the obligations?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, the ART exam is often used as a component of the audit. So when we are measuring grain and evaluating whether they meet those requirements that I just laid out, that will be taken into account for the CPA audit, and often those numbers will be used in the financial audit, but they are two separate things and are conducted by two separate entities.
Okay. Senator Dietzick has a follow-up, and then Senator Dreheim has a question. And Senator Dietzick, before you start, I think you're referencing a letter from the representative from the of some farmers,
yes.
Jason Lina.
Yes.
Just for members in the audience, there is copies of that in the back. A page can get that to you if you want to raise your hand or go get it yourself. That's I think, the letter she's referring to about audits and reviews. But Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. So you mentioned that your inspection might be used as part of an audit. And in this letter, it appears there wasn't an audit done. Do we being Minnesota or the statutes or you all under rules or thrust, were they required to do an audit and they didn't do it? Or is that something that we should be looking at? Again, it's more red tape, but it's, you know, in this case, it might have protected the farmer sooner. And so do we require or should be requiring a yearly audit or every other year, or any thoughts?
Mr. Milanowski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have discussed this in the Grain Advisory Group. The audit itself is not required in statute. One of the systems and considerations that were taken into account in a legislative change in 2012 was that in order to be bonded, a lot of bond companies go through a financial review of these facilities. Whether it's a submitted financial that is submitted to the bonding company or an audited financial like we're discussing, the thought there was that in order to be bonded, you need to go through some sort of review. What we found recently is that can vary widely. Some bonding companies are requiring a audited financial, and most of our facilities in the state are doing either a reviewed financial or an audited financial. Audited is a higher tier, has to meet a lot more requirements, but reviewed is reviewed by a CPA. One of the suggestions in that grain advisory group is that a audited financial be required annually or maybe on a schedule of every 3 years or every 5 years. But I should mention that those audited financials come at a significantly higher cost to the elevator, oftentimes tens of thousands of dollars for facilities that are relatively small.
Senator Dreheim, and then we'll try to move on to the next presenter.
Thank you, Chair. The bonds, when we look at what we do here in Minnesota versus the USDA, is there a difference in bond requirements?
Mr. Milanowski?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dreheim. Yes, the bonds are actually pretty similar to the USDA. I do have my notes here in terms of the max value of the bonds. If you'll bear with me, we've looked into neighboring states as well as the USDA. The max value for a USDA bond is $500,000. The minimum value is $50,000. So our minimum is significantly lower. It's 20% of what the USDA requires. Some of our neighboring states have no max limit, South Dakota being one of them. Kansas, Nebraska, those states are all using bonding programs currently. Their max value for their bonds is $500,000 as well. So that $500,000 upper limit seems to be consistent with some of the other states that are using bonds.
Senator Lang has a question. Or Senator Graham, do you have a follow-up?
I was just going to thank him because that was my next question. What were the neighboring states doing? So,
okay. Senator Lang and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, actually, that was I had the exact same question written down, and I appreciate that. Obviously, the department in this particular circumstance isn't to blame, and you guys are probably shaking your head just like the committee is here. You mentioned the investigation initially. At the end of this investigation, I know you can't comment on it specifically, but are there financial penalties that the department can push upon? Whether you're talking about the board of directors, which, you know, by the letter in our packet seems to have some sort of culpability in this, or is this merely a finding of fact?
Mr. Milanowski?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I'll say is that we do have the authority under Chapter 18J to enforce against Ashby Elevator. But that hasn't been determined yet, and that would be something that I think would have to go to our commissioner's office for determination.
So, Mr. Milanowski, Senator Lang, follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a committee, we're sitting here, there's a couple of different routes that we probably can take as a committee to try to remedy this, not particular case, but in the future. We require licensing, and then we require that that all these facilities are licensed in the same way and that they are audited. As you mentioned, that adds significant financial aspect to it. I don't know if I'm readily accepting that. Also, that we've been talking about, what kind of indemnity fund are we looking at? Is it something where the state should be concerned about trying to compensate the farmers in this? That's one thing that we all in this committee say again and again and again, that we care about the farmers. But in this case, I don't think it's the state's fault or problem. So I guess, what are the chances of financial recoupment from the individual in question? And I know that it's an ongoing investigation. I totally understand. But is there a chance out there? You showed some numbers on there. We were talking, single-digit percentages, and I don't think that's going to be acceptable in this circumstances. So.
Senator Lang, maybe I'll step in. I think a couple of the next testifiers might have a little more insight to some of your question. And so, Mr. Milanowski, to the extent you want to answer part of that, I realize you might not have all the answer, and then we'll call up one of the next testifiers.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Our investigation is only looking at the bond currently, the current bond of $125,000 held by Ashby. Anything outside of that investigation is up to the bankruptcy court or some sort of criminal complaint. I can't speculate to that. We've got our hands full with what we're doing here, and we're focused on that.
And Mr. Milanowski, thank you for your presentation. Just as you're departing, and I assume you'll stick around if there's further questions, but... you mentioned the stakeholder group that you guys have been meeting. When will you meet next, and how soon could you have some recommendations back for our committee, potentially this year and in the next 4 to 6 weeks? Or what are you planning with the stakeholders group that you've been meeting with to review this situation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a meeting scheduled or tentatively scheduled for February 28th. We've invited a CPA firm that is very experienced with grain elevator financial audits to lay out for the entire grain advisory group what is their process for financial auditing. Allow us to all understand exactly how an audit is conducted, what components are taken into consideration. We have drafted some language on the MDA side to address some procedural changes that we can make to potentially make our inspections more robust or require more from our license holders. So we do have something on the books. It's a little ways out here, but February 28th. Okay. Answer that question.
And anybody interested in coming to that, is that a public meeting? And who would they get a hold of?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is a public meeting, and they can email me, Whitney Place.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Milanowski and Ms. Place from the Department of Agriculture. Appreciate your overview, and we'll probably have many more questions, but thanks for that. Next, Eric Algren, attorney representing the co-op and the bankruptcy situation. Mr. Algren from the Fergus Falls area, welcome to our committee, and if you can identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your overview and perspective that you can offer us as a committee, and we'll open it up for some questions after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Eric Algren. I'm an attorney from Fergus Falls, and I originally was representing the co-op itself. As of the turn of the year, I've become appointed as the assignee, kind of like a receiver in an assignment for the benefit of creditors. And folks have been referring to this as a bankruptcy, and in some ways, an assignment for the benefit of creditors is like a state law bankruptcy, but it's not officially a bankruptcy. I act as a bankruptcy trustee, and so I make that distinction between the federal law bankruptcy court actions and what we're doing here, which is an assignment for the benefit of creditors, which is a form of receivership. Okay. I got involved with this company or this situation September 7th. I got a phone call from the president of the board, and he said he didn't know what was going on, but the bank was threatening to foreclose and threatening to come in and essentially close the place down. I ended up calling the attorney for the bank, co-bank in this case, and he gave me a little bit of an overview of the situation, but really it was pretty much that they had been giving notice to the co-op that their loan was going to come due September 1st. They weren't going to extend it. They had been told that it was going to be refinanced, and now they couldn't find the general manager. He wasn't returning their phone calls. And so, yes, they were trying to create pressure on the board. And the board was feeling pressure. They got a hold of me. September 10th, I met with the board, and at that time, really all we knew is that the general manager had been on vacation. They had been struggling to get a hold of him. They thought the loan was being refinanced. We found out kind of through the course of that morning in meeting with the board that there was no grain inventory there, literally like $40,000, $50,000 in grain inventory. Now, this is September 10th, so that's maybe not all that surprising, because you want to be lowering your grain inventories in anticipation of the fall crops coming in. So the next question was, well, if we don't have any inventory here, do we have big accounts receivable? And so I had the staff contacting our three main customers, and literally there are pretty much three main customers. They take in the grain. They essentially aggregate it and sell it out to some bigger grain buyers. And the answer came back through the course of that morning, nothing, nothing, nothing. There were no accounts receivable. And from that last Friday, I had gotten financial statements from the bank, but those were from March. And they showed about $7 million of inventory. We had no inventory. There were no corresponding accounts receivable. And so about that time, we were pretty worried. We said, there's a problem here. That afternoon, I contacted an accounting firm out of Fargo and had them send a couple of their forensic auditors, which are essentially investigative auditors, to the co-op the next morning. That next day, Tuesday, the 11th, they went through a really kind of an interview process with the staff. At the end of that day, I did a telephone conference with the staff and the auditors, and really it was pretty much they were just going to take the information back and try to figure out, try to put it together and give a better idea of what they thought the next steps should be. Over the course of that evening and the next day, I started looking through the bank records, the online bank records, and started finding checks written out to questionable entities. And really, in the end, what we found out, this was really a very simple fraud. What happened is that the vast majority of the checks that were unauthorized checks had been signed by the general manager, who was nowhere to be found at that time. And they were written out to credit card companies, to other, what we then found out were, in a lot of situations, safari providers, taxidermists, a lot of the fraud really was strictly money that wasn't going to any particular, wasn't being saved, wasn't being put away. It was just essentially being burned through. As was stated by the Department of Agriculture, that Friday, the 14th, we had another board meeting, and we decided we were going to have to close. From that Monday, from that first meeting, we had made the decision we weren't going to take any more grain in because we knew there was a problem on that Monday. And to take in grain at that time, I think would have been dishonest on our part, because at that point I think we had a pretty good understanding that we weren't going to be able to pay for it. That Friday, the 14th, we made the decision to notify all of our members that we were closing, and we went through a process of trying to find another party that could come in and reopen the elevator. Because really, this elevator is very important to the local farmers and to the community of Ashby. And within a month, by October 3rd, we had it reopened again under a new manager, under a new company that could take on financial responsibility for it. And they've continued to operate it through today. We're hoping that's going to be a long-term partner that's going to be able to purchase the facility. There are some other issues that, unless the committee wants to get into them, aren't really relevant here. But we're hoping to get that done over the next few months or so. When I look at this, one of the big problems is that we did not have good internal controls. There is no pussyfooting around that. We did not have good internal controls. It's a small company, but even as a small company, we did not have good internal controls. Number two is there weren't audits being done. And as someone who works primarily in the insolvency area, a big part of what I do is act as a bankruptcy trustee or deal with other insolvency issues, I got to admit that surprised me a lot, that there was no audit being done. I work with much smaller entities, farmers and other smaller companies where audits are being required. And part of it is, there's no question, part of that responsibility lies with CoBank, the bank in this case. Most of the time, it's the bank that requires an audit to be done. The bank here had been doing business with the co-op since 1985, which is when I graduated from college. And let me tell you, that's a long time ago. But I think maybe their comfort with that long-term relationship let them somehow just allow the company not to conduct an audit. Interestingly, though, and this is important to understand, how this whole thing came to light, why the whole house of cards fell down, is because starting in January of 2018, CoBank had been giving notice to the general manager that they were going to require an audit. And I'm sure that must have scared the heck out of him. As of June of 2018, CoBank, in this case, gave notice to the co-op that they weren't going to extend the loan. The loan had come due, and as is good practice, they told them 3 months ahead of time that they weren't going to be extending the loan because they hadn't been able to get an audit from the elevator in this case. So clearly, in this case, when I look at it, if an audit had been done, it's something that would have allowed this fraud to be discovered. The other kind of interesting part, when I look at this, we've done a lot of looking at the checks and trying to determine how this fraud took place and when it started. I can't tell you exactly when it started. I think it was sometime around 2003. And you can tell by the checks being written that it started out kind of on a low level. In 2003, there are some checks that we look at and go, those don't look like authorized checks, but it's not 100% certain. They seem to have been continuing 2004 and 2005. In 2006, it was the first check we find to the Mulehead Ranch from Bonesteel, South Dakota. And then he went again. Then he went to Alaska. Then he went to Africa. And you can just kind of see what's happening. What's happening is he's noticing that nobody's watching what's happening. Before I got here today, I was at a hearing for the Petters Ponzi scheme, which is still going on after about 10 years. And in a lot of ways, I see similarities. In some ways, clearly this is much smaller than the Petters Ponzi scheme. But in a lot of ways, there are a lot of similarities between the two. I don't think people get involved in these kind of frauds just wake up one morning and think, I'm going to steal millions of dollars. Or in the case of Petters, you know, a billion or more dollars. I think it's something that happens. They kind of start small, and it just kind of takes on on itself. I think a big part of it is, if you can avoid the party, in this case the wrongdoing party, if you can make it so that there's a much greater likelihood that they're going to get caught early, I think these things don't take off. I think this is something that got out of control in large part because it wasn't being watched. There was no good procedure for having it watched. And the Department of Agriculture testified, and correctly, that they don't conduct an audit with a grain buyer. Here there was a grain buyer. It's a grain buyer license. They came in annually to do a review, but they really only review what is on site. In this case, part of the fraud was that the general manager was giving notice to both the bank and the Department of Agriculture that they had off-site storage. The fact is, there was no off-site storage. Those annual reports, the report that was done by the Department of Agriculture in January of 2018, specifically says it's just reviewing what's on site and that what's on site matches what they were told was on site. Attached to that report were 5 or 6 pages saying this other grain was being stored off-site. There is no review of that, but that was being given to the bank as well. And that, I think, is a real glitch in the system. The bank was being given insurance certificates for fictitious inventory. It was being given reports that tend to look official, that there was off-site inventory. But if you read the report carefully, it's saying, we're not really looking at that. We're only looking at what's on-site. When I look at this, there's plenty of blame to go around, plenty of ways that it could have been caught, but was not. There weren't good internal controls. There's no question that's something that's the responsibility of the entity itself. One of the issues there is that the boards on these for these elevators are kind of like nonprofit boards. They're part-time. You have a meeting maybe just quarterly, maybe not even quarterly. There aren't enough guidelines, I think, for what are essentially volunteer boards of what can be pretty significant entities. The bank did not require an audit. The inspection reports that were done by the Department of Agriculture, from my mind, are insufficient. And you put all those together, and we had somebody who was able to really run rampant, steal what we can find is at least $5.5 million and live a lavish lifestyle doing it. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Algren. Members, questions, I'll start real briefly, and because we want to make sure we leave time for the rest as well, but just touch base on what kind of recovery you potentially anticipate, and I'm not asking for anything that might be not public or not something you want to discuss, but just give us an idea of, we've talked about the $125,000 bond, which is not much for the claims, but what else are you looking at in a brief overview?
Yeah. A big part of why board made the assignment for the benefit of creditors is that allows me then as the representative of the creditors to bring claims under the Minnesota Uniform Fraudulent Transactions Act, which can only be brought by creditors or a representative of the creditors. So now I'm in a position where I'm the representative of the creditors. That allows me to bring claims against folks who received unauthorized checks. There are some possible defenses for those folks who received unauthorized checks, but what was happening here is you had people who were providing safaris, taking checks from a co-op. To me, there's just no possible way you could take a check from a co-op to pay for somebody's safari or to pay for somebody's taxidermy. There's no possible way that if you looked at the check, which says right on it, Ashby Farmers Cooperative Elevator Company, if you paid any attention to what you were doing, that you were taking money from an entity that had no business, that had no legitimate reason to be going on safaris or to be doing taxidermy or to be purchasing land or to be doing many other things. So I'm going to be bringing claims against parties who I believe received fraudulent transfers. One of the things that I discussed with the board as they were making the assignment for the benefit of creditors is that I'm going to be bringing a claim on against the directors and officers. They understand that. but there is going to be a directors and officers liability claim. There's $1 million of D&O insurance. There is a crime policy that the elevator had. That's $100,000, which is really just a drop in the bucket here. But those are going to be really the three main sources: selling the assets of the elevator, the fraudulent transfer claims, and potentially a directors and officers liability claim.
Okay. Senator Goggin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is, when you were reviewing these checks and everything, is there any times where they require two signatures on the check, or how did they do that, or did he just have carte blanche with the checkbook?
It was a single signature on the check. I think it would be a much better internal control to have two signatures on it. There are a number of interesting things about that, too. The fact is he would be writing checks through the course of the year, and it was just at the end of the year that a lot of them were entered into the system at all. And that was as the, in this case, the off-site bookkeeper was trying to balance the books. And so they'd be entered, in a lot of cases, 12/31 of whatever year. But it was, there's no way around it. There were poor internal controls, and that's a part of it.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems odd that the off-site bookkeeper wouldn't say, why are you writing checks to outfitters and other organizations that really don't seem like they would apply to a grain co-op?
The off-site bookkeeper would not necessarily see the actual checks. It would be entered oftentimes with just a name, and then it would say corn or wheat. But there were many of those checks that were entered to, for example, the Cabela's Club Visa card that said it was for corn, beans, or wheat. And I would concur with your concern why that was not seen as a problem.
Any other questions, members? Mr. Algren, thank you for your testimony and wanting to move on. I would like to have Mr. Jason Lina come up, but thank you for making the trip and sharing this information with us to continue digesting this, and we may have follow-up questions if that's all right. Okay.
That's fine. Thank you, committee.
Thank you again. Mr. Lina, identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and go ahead, and then we'll open it up for some questions, and then we'll ask the farm groups and the stakeholders to please be ready following Mr. Lina's testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Wester, members of the committee. My name is Jason Lina. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Flugel Anderson McLaughlin and Brutlag in Morris, Minnesota. Shortly after the timeline that Mr. Algren discussed with all of you, one of the farmers called us and said, okay, so things are going downhill with the Ashby elevator. What do we do to protect ourselves? They contacted us, and we had a meeting with about 10 of the farmers down in our office late September, early October, and then had another meeting up in Ashby, I want to say probably roughly about 100 people, probably representing roughly 44 of the members of the co-op attended. We discussed with them some of the issues and some of the problems. What they're looking for is, how are we going to get paid? And we said to them, well, there's a grain buyer's bond. Well, how much is that? $125,000. Well, you know from earlier testimony, there's already $2.5 million in claims, and based on our estimates, we expect there'll probably be about $4 million worth of claims. Simply, the reaction of farmers to, well, there's $125,000 out there, would be about what you could expect. The grain buyer's bond is just not high enough to protect farmers in this situation. It's very inadequate. I know there was some discussion back during the Porter elevator case about whether the whether Minnesota should increase the amount of that grain buyer's bond. Probably it should. Two reasons. First of all, to provide additional protection to farmers. Second of all, with those higher bond amounts, you're going to have the bond companies looking at those elevators a little more closely when they issue those bonds. And so that's going to end up being one of your checks on these elevators to make sure that somebody is watching them. Now, I didn't address that in my letter because I understand that that was considered previously but maybe rejected after the Porter elevator case. I know there was some discussion about, well, maybe we should have a producer checkoff that creates a pool of money for situations like that. Again, this isn't a producer problem. This is an elevator problem. I don't think that the solution here is to pass the buck on to the producers to provide a pool of money for themselves, for their own protection. This is about the elevators and the elevators having the proper oversight. Which brings me to the issues that I raised in my letter and ultimately what we've decided as a firm that we can do to help the people that have come to us. As you heard from Mr. Algren, there is a good effort being made by his office to claw back and collect as much of this money as can be done. But this was a real failure of the board of directors to supervise that elevator. And that board of directors should be the first line of defense against something like this. And we believe a claim against the director should be vigorously pursued. With the receivership coming into play, we've got to have some discussions with Mr. Algren about who's best to pursue that claim, and that's not anything that this committee concerns itself with. But what this committee probably does understand but needs to really internalize is that in these situations with these small elevators, the manager is looked at with a great deal of respect. This is a guy who is considered by most people in the community to be a smart guy who really understands grain buying and grain selling. And while there are certainly situations where you have an experienced board member on a board, some of the people that come on to be on boards, while they may be sophisticated as farmers, they maybe aren't sophisticated in terms of what their role is in overseeing a board. They have a fiduciary duty, an obligation to treat that board or to treat that entity as they would their own personal affairs. And I think it's fairly clear that in this situation, that board did not do that. Why that is, I can't tell you. We think that part of the problem is that there isn't an education of board members. You come onto a board, there's nothing that tells a board member, this is what my obligations and responsibilities are. To a large extent, you're probably relying on the manager to tell you what you're supposed to do. And we think that's inadequate. So to some extent, we think that if this committee wanted to consider some options, some sort of education being provided for board members so that they can understand what their obligations are so that they're able to better police situations like that, we think that's a good option. I think there was some confusion over what Department of Agriculture does in terms of inspections and audits. There are no requirements for audits, but what happened in this situation is the manager would go out to an independent firm and ask them for what's referred to as a compilation. And a compilation is just that firm looks over the information that manager presents to him. They're not coming in and independently looking at every aspect of the elevator, maybe the way they should be. They're looking just at what that manager provides them. In this situation, I think the problem is that the board would get this annual compilation and everything looks good. No blame to the accounting firm. They're doing what they were retained to do, but that board didn't necessarily know what actually it had in front of it, whether it had a full audit or whether it had a compilation. So we suggest that perhaps some requirement of some independent auditing of elevators may be a good thing for this committee to consider. That's basically the extent of what I wanted to present to you. I'm certainly willing to take questions if the committee has some.
Senator Frentz has a question. Senator Frentz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Lina. So whether we're talking about Ashby or any elevator around the state, how much does the producer get information about the bond amount and the annual purchases? I mean, would they have known in 2017, hey, we're talking about this much in annual purchases. By the way, we only got a bond of 125. And if so, would a notice requirement be of any help to some of these producers?
Potentially. Generally speaking, I would say that they don't have that information. You know, they'll have what information is provided at an annual meeting. You know, they don't necessarily know that. There were situations in this case where some of our producers were aware of a bond requirement, but I would say by and large, the fact that it was as small as it was did come as quite a surprise to them.
Senator Frentz, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just the question for the committee of, is there any benefit to the producers and some kind of notice requirement where you talked about sophistication? Would it help producers to hear something like, we're going through $5 million of annual purchases? By the way, in 2018, the bond is only 125, and just something for us to think about if that's of any help to prevent this in the future. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick has a question.
I didn't know if you had a follow-up.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could briefly address that bond requirement is true of most elevators. I mean, it's not like that producer can go and choose in the marketplace. That bond is going to be low at most any elevator they go to. So they would have that information. They would know that there's not that much of a bond there, but they don't exactly have the freedom to say, okay, well, I'll go to another elevator that has a higher bond because those aren't going to exist.
Senator Dietzick and Mr. Zelenka from the Elevators Association will be up next, so he might be able to address this as well, Senator Frentz. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I have some comments and a question. And so
go ahead.
I don't think some of the education, I appreciate that you're discussing boards need education, and board members don't always either know what to ask or feel they have authority to ask, and lots of times, just from my experience, not with grain elevator co-ops, but with other nonprofit boards or community boards, they don't understand the fiduciary duty that they have. They also usually have a very knowledgeable and, like you said, influential executive director or manager who is able to either steer the questions or box members out when they start to ask questions. So I do think that's an issue. I think a question for the committee to consider as we're moving forward is, does the AG's office offer some type of training to nonprofit boards and maybe make that open to some of these grain elevators? Because I do think just in general there is this problem of the education. And then as a follow-up to that, in your letter you mentioned, should we require audits? And I think maybe some of that, but they also are expensive. And so they will add to the cost of doing business. And so what is that balance is like how many years? And then, again, in this case, you know, how much of this was also the bank falling down and not asking for an audit sooner? And so there's that balance. I don't want to, you know, when farmers are also right now under a lot of pressure for pricing, and then if we add to this other requirement, and audits cost money, like somebody said, so what is that balance and how much of this was, again, the bank didn't do their job.
Mr. Lina, comment on that, and then we'll ask Mr. Zelenka to come up.
I don't want to get into talking about what the bank should or shouldn't have done here, but, you know, we do have situations where Department of Ag will come in and do some inspections. There is the concern about the cost of an audit, but at the same time, how do you deal with the fact that you have these small elevators that, for some of our clients, particularly with the way the farm economy is right now, this is a huge hit to them. This is potentially losing their retirement. This could mean losing the farm to them. Certainly you want to be respectful of the finances of a small elevator, but at the same time, there has to be something there, whether it be higher bonds or something that makes sure, that gives some assurances that these things are going to be watched before you're in a situation like this where they're going to get pennies on the dollar.
Let me follow up, Senator Dietzick. Very good. Mr. Lina, thank you for making the trip down and participating in our hearing today. We appreciate hearing from you and that perspective. members, Mr. Zelenka from the Elevators Association. And following that will be Farm Bureau with Josie Linetti.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. I'll be retiring in April, so I'm going to turn this over to Laura, who's going to be taking over my position here effective in April. I've been with the organization 38 years. I've seen a lot of things happen in these 38 years. This Ashby Farmers Elevator situation was probably one of the most unique situations I've ever seen in those 38 years. I think Greg Knopf and I probably have the same tenure spending time around this this place. Our association represents grain elevators and feed mills here in the state of Minnesota. Our association is 112 years old. We have a mixture of cooperatives and independents. Industry has consolidated quite a bit. When I started in 1981, there was 275 local grain cooperatives. Today, we're down to 70 local grain cooperatives with about 240 branch locations. And in addition to that, you have 125 private elevators. CHS owns about 55 elevators. Cargill's got about 10 or 12. So it's kind of a mixed bag of facilities that are out there in Minnesota. Ashby, a co-op, small co-op, one of those still existing small co-ops. I might mention, has not been a member of our association for several years. When they were a member, never very actively involved, if at all, in our association. Just want to make that point clear. For our testimony, I'd like to turn this over to Laura Lemke. And Laura, if you want to introduce yourself.
Laura, welcome to our committee. Identify yourself for the record and tell us, and realize we're down to about 15, 20 minutes left. And
absolutely.
So members, we might go a little over, but we certainly, this isn't the end of the discussion. I think it's there's more to discuss. So if you could share with us, and you'll be welcome back in the future as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Laura Lemke. I'm the Assistant Director for the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. And thank you for the opportunity to be here today and testify in front of you. First, we'd like to thank the Minnesota Department of Agriculture for pulling together the Grain Advisory Group that we've been active in since August of 2018. It should go without saying that we do sympathize with the producers from the Ashby Farmers Cooperative. What they're going through is something I'm sure they never expected to. That being said, our industry, especially cooperatives, have really been dealt a black eye in this situation. It's not fair to punish our entire industry for one man's greed and a board of directors' complete failure to do their job. They had a fiduciary responsibility to their cooperative members, and they didn't do it, and not just for a couple years, but for a long time. One point I'd like to make, grain bonds, it's been brought up a lot today. Grain bonds are not insurance. There is this, people seem to think that it's insurance. It isn't. It is simply a screening process of an elevator's financial stability by an independent third party. That's what they are. They are not meant to be, they're not meant to cover any complete loss. Audits have also been brought up today. I pulled some numbers together, got a hold of a couple of CPA firms in preparation for today. A full audit will run anywhere from $15,000 to $65,000 for a cooperative. That number is dependent on the size and the complexity of the client, but they do sink a significant amount of money into audits. A review statement is more affordable in that $5,000 to $10,000 range, and a compilation statement, which is the lowest level of service that accountants perform, and it essentially takes the accounting records provided by the client and puts it into the financial statement format. There's no attestation to accuracy by the CPA firm. One member of ours that I spoke with, they pay around $6,000 for that. I also did an informal survey of our members. Of those, 45% perform full audits. 43% perform a review, 8% perform a compilation, and 4% have a commission firm audit. That being said, if the committee has any questions for us, Bob and I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mrs. Lemke. Members, any questions? Senator Dietzick.
Sorry, thank you. One question. When you said they do you gave numbers for those that do an audit and a review, are those annually or every other year?
Annually, yes. For a grain bond, Bob and I are both insurance agents as well, and the members that put their bonds through the association, we are required to request financial statements, review, compilation, or full audit from those entities every year before the surety company will renew their bond.
Any follow-up? So, Ms. Lemke.
I have one other thing. Can I add?
Yeah. Sorry. Let me ask my question, sure. And maybe it fits into yours, but the earlier testimony or comments about a higher bond would trigger maybe more scrutiny. Any thoughts or reaction to that? And when was our bond level last adjusted? But go ahead with your comments as well.
Thank you. In looking through my notes, I believe 2004 was the last year that bond amounts were increased. What was the rest of the question?
Mr. Chairman, I think the...
Mr. Zelenka.
The bonds themselves, I think you're right. The bonding companies, when they have more invested, the bond is higher, they're going to take a closer look at it. On the flip side, you have to look at the impact that it has on the firms that are being bonded.
Sure.
A maximum bond, a $500,000 maximum bond, will cost an elevator around $4,000 premium. If you start increasing the bonds too high, you start looking at squeezing out perhaps the smaller operators who maybe can't afford the higher premium. But I think in balance, the bonding companies take a close look at all the applications and the bonds that they write. And I don't think they slight any a buyer bond versus if you had a buy store bond, that type of thing, generally.
Sure.
They have certain requirements, certain requirements on net worth, working capital, debt to worth ratio, those kinds of things. So no matter what you have, you have to meet those basic requirements in order to get a bond. And without a bond, you can't get a license.
Sure. Senator Lang has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a couple of questions that I was hoping to get answered through the last couple of testifiers. And I asked this of the administration, and this is probably pure speculation, and this may be for Mr. Algren or Mr. Lena too, and if you can answer some of this, but is there a chance, and this is kind of a question. When you said 5.5 was missing on assets, did that 5.5 correlate directly with how much money had been spent? Is that, I don't know how a better way of phrasing that, but did the individual in question actually spend that much money? Or is there a chance that there's money out there that could be recovered?
Mr. Zelenka or Ms. Lemke, do you have any answer to that? Otherwise, I'd ask Mr. Algren to come back if he has any perspective. Mr. Algren, do you want to just address that question for Senator Lang?
Yes, the $5.5 million is unauthorized checks that we've been able to uncover to date. It's been a number that's been moving up as we've learned more and more. I don't think that we've uncovered all of the unauthorized checks, but that's the number we've found to date. And those are checks for personal credit cards, additions to his house. A little over $2 million of that is going to be safaris and taxidermy. It's his personal expenditures.
I appreciate that. So I guess there's a couple of questions. I mean, it just opens up a whole other book for me. But
go ahead, Senator Lang. We are getting a little crunched on
that.
Time, as you know.
I'll take two more short little stabs at it here. But how far does this go back?
We can find it back to about 2003. And that's what I was stating earlier, that About 2003 is when we're finding the first of what we think are the unauthorized checks, and it's something that we can see by the checks we've found really kind of ramps up and then takes off.
Senator Lang, any follow-up?
Just one last question.
The
accused that we're talking about, the person in question here, what's the story with him? Do we have him in custody? Is it something where the charges have been filed? Is the house seized?
That could take me a half hour to give you the full story on that. I'll try to give you the
30-second version.
The 30-second version. He originally went on the run. He has since turned himself in. He has an ankle bracelet on him and is restricted to can't leave the state of Minnesota. I understand that in mid-February there is a date for him to, and I understand he is going to plead guilty, assuming the federal government is still open at that time, because these are federal charges.
Thank you, Mr. Algren. That's. I have more, but we'll wait for another day.
Very good. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Algren. Mr. Zelenka or Lemke, any final comments or questions, members?
Very good. I had one final comment
for
you.
Go ahead, Ms. Lemke, and then we'll have, if Josie from the Farm Bureau wants to come up and be ready, that'd be great.
If farmers or producers are concerned about the elevator that they're doing business with, they have the opportunity to buy private insurance for their grain contracts. It's called deferred payment insurance. It costs around $10 a thousand, and the elevator that they want to buy it through needs to have their fiscal year-end statement scrutinized by the company underwriting that product. So again, their financials are being looked at, and then a producer can buy insurance through them.
So Ms. Lemke, that leads me to a quick thought or strategy. Could a producer buy a contract on one or a few loads that they deliver, even if they may have brought in 20,000 bushels, but buy it on only 2,000 or 3,000? And would that, the very nature of that contract being available, does that give them some indication that insurance has done this scrutiny? And if they couldn't get an insurance contract at that elevator, would that tell them something else?
Mr. Chairman, yes, if a producer was, if they wanted to buy that product through an elevator that they had grain with, that they had a contract with, and that elevator did not pass muster on their financials, yes, I believe they should be concerned. Beyond that,
to answer the contract, if you wanted to, you could have insurance on one, two, or multiple contracts. So you wouldn't have to cover all your contracts. It's okay. Up to you how much you would want to cover through or with this type of insurance.
But did I understand you correctly that insurance may not be available at some elevators because they didn't pass the muster?
The elevator has to, they have to have their financials scrutinized first by the underwriter to determine whether or not the insurance company, the underwriter, would like to offer that product through them.
Okay, so it'd be a good question to ask for farmers as a preliminary. But thank you. I know we need to get to Farm Bureau. Thanks for your contributing to this hearing. And
Mr. Chairman, one quick thing.
Mr. Zelenka.
Last March, we had a session at our convention about fiduciary responsibility for cooperative directors.
Okay.
To address the question about education.
Very good. And you will be continuing with the stakeholders group, Mr. Zelenka, and the
Yes, we will.
Association.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Linetti from the Farm Bureau, and then on deck would be Gary Wertisch from Farmers Union. If you want to be ready and come right up as soon as she's done, or come join her, and then Patrick Murray from the Cooperative Network, and that will round out our testifiers for today. Ms. Linetti, welcome. Identify yourself for the record and present. Tell us what you'd like us to hear about this situation.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Josie Linetti, Associate Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Farm Bureau. In the interest of time, I will be succinct in my testimony this afternoon. Farm Bureau has been involved in conversations with the Department of Agriculture in the Grain Advisory Group with a variety of other stakeholders as we've looked at different avenues to improve protections for producers in situations of elevator insolvency. This is certainly an issue that is what our membership has been talking about extensively at our annual meeting this past November. Our delegates engaged in a long conversation and decided upon policy. Specifically, we support the Minnesota Department of Agriculture requiring independent annual audits or other safeguard measures to ensure that grain dealers and buyers are sufficiently bonded to prevent a loss to farmers in cases of insolvency. And additionally, we are opposed to a state or checkoff-funded program to indemnify agriculture producers. We believe that by requiring independent annual audits or other safeguard measures, these would act as preventative measures to combat fraud on the front end and ensure that elevator financials are reviewed on a regular basis. We certainly, look forward to working with all of you and working with the other groups to come to some type of solution for this problem, whatever that might look like. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Linetti. Members, any brief questions? Mr. Wordish, why don't you go ahead from Farmers Union, identify yourself for the record, please, and then Mr. Murray, I'll have you follow up. And
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Gary Wordish. I'm president of Minnesota Farmers Union. I live in Renville County, live on a farm. I rent my farm to my son, so this part, and I farmed all my life until I started taking this job and renting my farm to my son, so I still help him very actively involved. It's been talked a lot about today here, and, we talk a lot about more audits and more bonding level, different things, do that stuff, but in reality, we're not talking about farmers. I'm here representing farmers. I believe, we have the part of the Department of Ag's job is to represent or to protect farmers. All the issues that we're talking about here today, we're just kicking the can down the road. We're not taking a hard look at it. We can do more audits. We can require a little bit of bonding. You take the Ashby elevator, you're going to have about a $5 million loss. If you require them, the only way they would be protected is if they had a bond at that level. They can't afford a bond at that level. That would drive them out of business. They can't afford that. You can do audits. You can. I sit on a lot of boards, and I'm involved with a lot of boards, and we can blame board members, and that's very true. It's hard to really know your responsibilities and the extent of it. We can train board members. We can do all that, and that's all good ideas. I'm not saying we dismiss any of that stuff. That's all good, but I don't want to get a call from a farmer. We got some of them 2 years ago at Porter. Went, how come you guys aren't doing nothing? I delivered grain, and I'll get 10 cents on the dollar, whatever the number is here. This could drive people off the farm. This could break people, and it will. We got enough stress in farm country right now due to low prices and some trade policies that are very detrimental to farmers. Everybody's sitting in this room. We all talk about agriculture. We all support agriculture. Here we have a chance to look at an issue. If we just kick this can down the road, we require a little more audits, a little more board training, a little more bonding, we're going to be sitting here again in a few years. There's going to be another one that'll go down. When we heard the Porter elevator, when that one went down, we heard that time, well, it's a small private elevator. It can't happen to a co-op. Co-ops, their memberships, they have annual meetings, they get the financial records, they get audited records, so it can't happen to a co-op. Ashby was a co-op. Unless, you can have them audited. I know personally, I know of an elevator, there was an embezzlement by a staff member. It didn't break the elevator, and it didn't cost the producers anything. They were okay, but that went on for a long period of time before the auditor caught it. So it can happen. We're all aware of the very large corporations that have a staff of attorneys, staff of auditors, staff of accountants. It happens. If somebody's going to want to do it, they can do it. And a regular audit will not catch it all. The only way you're going to really catch everything is a forensic audit. And they can't afford to do a forensic audit every year. So we're back to the situation. I believe the Department of Ag, I sit on the advisory council too, and I've been in the meetings. And we asked, at one of the last meetings, we asked the Department of Ag to take a look at what are the surrounding states doing. How is it working for them? And the identity fund was in a lot of states. North Dakota has one. I believe it's at $10 million, and they haven't had to dip into it yet. When I look at the department's numbers, and they conservatively, to get a $10 million fund raised, and if you charge 0.001 cent per dollar for that, you would raise the $10 million in approximately 365 days. When I compare that to a checkoff dollar on corn, our checkoff dollar is a penny a bushel. So in my area, you know, if you raise a 200 bushel an acre crop, that penny a bushel is costing us $2 an acre. So if you take a 200 bushel an acre crop, sell it for $3, nice round number, that's $600. At that 0.001 cents, that's 60 cents an acre. I think farmers, if they know that 60 cents an acre is buying them insurance, that'll protect them when they deliver to that elevator, whatever business they're doing with, that their check's going to be good. The Porter elevator, we heard it. There was one producer took his grain into that elevator that day, got the check that same day, walked over to the bank. Check was no good. Things are going to fall through the cracks. I think an identity fund, I don't think we should dismiss that. It's been, you know, we haven't talked a lot about it. I think we should look at it. I think the producers, we buy crop insurance, we buy house insurance. We never need that either until our house catches on fire. So I think identity fund, if we picked a number, and I think, you know, we could look at all the other stuff too, but I strongly support looking at an identity fund, pick the number if it's $10 million, according to their numbers. If it takes a year to raise the $10 million, I would say leave it on for the full year. And if you raise $15 million, that's great. Leave it on for a full year so everybody that sells grain that year is paying into it. Then it shuts off. Then it stays there, sits there. It's available in case of failure of an elevator in the future or some business in the future. So I don't think that should be dismissed, and I think it's unrealistic to expect the Department of Ag to catch all this stuff either, because we can't give them enough money. You wouldn't be able to give them enough money to do the job they have to do. And I think it was mentioned earlier, it's a state's issue. Well, the $10 million is the identity fund. You know, the state can put that $10 million in there, but realistically, you know, you're not going to be able to do that either. If you want to do that, yeah, we're great. Then we don't need a checkoff. But I think I would encourage the committee not to dismiss it, and let's keep looking at the issues and strongly consider that, because I think that's the only thing that's really going to protect the farmers. And I don't want to, as they work with sons and other people, they're important to keep on the farm. They're having enough struggles. They don't need to, you know, and to expect them to go in and check the financials of the elevator, all those things can change. Things can be hidden. So I guess I've taken it's a passion of mine, and a passion of mine is representing farmers. That's why I'm here. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wordish. Mr. Murray with the Cooperative Networks, and then members, if you have any questions right after that, then we'll conclude this hearing. Mr. Murray, welcome to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Wordish, for your comments. And Mr. Murray, identify yourself for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Patrick Murray. I'm the Senior Government Affairs Director for Cooperative Network. We are a two-state trade association of over 350 cooperatives between Minnesota and Wisconsin. Our membership includes many farm supply cooperatives located throughout both states. I will also say that Ashby Co-op Elevator is not a member of our trade association. We appreciate the opportunity to provide you with an update on our organization's role as a member of the Department of Agriculture's Grain Advisory Council. I would like to thank the department for including us on this council. Since the group was formed last summer, we've had several productive meetings that were held in August, October, and December of 2018. And in addition, we also had Mr. Milanowski came and spoke to one of our committee meetings up in Brainerd last fall. So we appreciate the access that he provided us to the members to talk about the grain licensing program that the department runs. He also talked to us about grain indemnity fund programs that are in surrounding states and other states throughout the country. Based upon those meetings and the discussions that I've had with my membership, it's our collective belief that before any effort to create a grain indemnity fund is initiated, other alternatives should be explored. This includes some of the options that we talked about earlier today, including financial reporting, expanded third-party financial auditing, as well as ongoing educational training for co-op board directors. Which brings me to my next point. One of the benefits of being a member of Cooperative Network is that we offer opportunities for director training for our board members. This can be basic as well as advanced cooperative governance. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, we had a symposium in Morton, Minnesota, where we had over 50 co-op board directors in attendance. The educational symposium focused on co-op governance and responsibilities of the directors, which includes their fiduciary responsibilities to their cooperatives and their member owners. This type of educational program is just one example of how the cooperative system continues to keep our members and their directors up to speed on how to govern their co-ops in a fiscally sound and prudent manner. Also, as I had mentioned earlier, Cooperative Network represents co-ops in both Minnesota and Wisconsin. Our members across the border, there's actually an indemnity fund program in place. It's the Agriculture Producer Security Program, again, which is their version of a grain indemnity fund. It's governed by the Agriculture Producer Security Council, which consists of 10 agriculture industry representatives that, in fact, includes a member from Cooperative Network on this board. So while there is a fund in place across the border, the members and our members would have some concern that if a fund were to be put in place here, that it would be funded by potential industry licensing fees and assessments. Some of the neighboring states that do have programs in place, they are funded through the general fund. So on the record, if that would be something that the direction of the committee or the department goes, and that would be what our position would be there. And as we move forward, again, if something is created here, we would like you, again, to consider these other alternatives that I've mentioned earlier, including ongoing co-op board director training. That's one of the key things that these co-ops continue to do, and it's a service that we provide to our members. So it's also the responsibility of the general manager to notify their board directors and for the board directors to know that there is training out there for them. So with that, I would just again like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I look forward to working with you and the department on this issue as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Members, any brief questions? Otherwise, I know we've gone over a little bit of our time. Any questions? Not right now. Mr. Murray and others, I'd want to encourage you to continue working with the stakeholders group and the Department of Ag and our committee as we look at this issue and address it through the committee process this year. We appreciate your feedback and want to highlight the importance of addressing these issues so our farmers can be secure in bringing their grain and delivering it to elevators. As I said before, this is farmers' cash, just like you and I bring it to the bank. And we've had a lot of good input, and I appreciate all the different parties that have brought the ideas forward. And certainly I would urge the stakeholders to follow up on this in February as you meet, but we need to probably hear back from you shortly after that meeting to have some meaningful issues brought in front of this committee to look at and address this issue or other issues that have happened in the past or prevent them from happening in the future. And so I appreciate everybody's attention to this, and committee members, thank you for your good questions, and we'll continue to monitor and work on this issue as we go forward. Meeting is adjourned.